we go. Get the white t-shirt on it.
Yeah.
If you watch the video, real progressive on the game plan measure, it's the one who told us.
No, I don't even have a
Right then, we can stay up.
Okay, as soon as we get the technology ready, we're actually gonna like gas, start on time. It'll be Joe, Mark, Roma. It'll be 15 minutes of uninterrupted presentation from each, and then we'll just open it up for discussion. I will ask that during the Q&A and discussion that crisp questions be posed. If you want to pose to one of the particular folks, you may do so. I'm going to be very strict. Do not pontificate or use this as an opportunity to give your pet theory or so forth. Ask questions and let our three folks engage the discussion. There are lots of opportunities for the other kinds of, you know, grappling together, but this one is a conference plenary, and we really want to have the three folks sort of make their case and ask challenging questions of them, but make sure they are questions. Theory, they're going to be nervous. All right. How are you, John?
Okay, ready to go?
You are okay.
You're on.
Welcome, folks. My name is David Cobb. I am one of the I'm a fellow with the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution. We are perhaps the anchor organization amongst over 50 organizations who are putting on this, the third Democracy Convention. I want to be clear that the Democracy Convention is actually a series of conferences on topics or sectors. This is the opening plenary of the conference on community and economic democracy. But at the same moment, there are conferences on media and democracy, racial justice and democracy, art and culture, education. I could go down the list, right? But what we are trying to do through this convention process is to let the various sectors come together, grapple with ideas, and be building towards a genuine democracy movement. You know, I have been part of an anti-war movement. I've been part of a racial justice movement. I've been part of so many different movements. And my assessment is that we are at the very beginning stages of what I will actually call a U.S. democracy movement. Because for the first time, perhaps, we are beginning to see social change agents confronting and grappling with the fact that we, the people, do not rule in this country. The word democracy, demos, the people, kratia, rule or power. Democracy just means the people rule or the people have the power. What we're recognizing is we don't actually have the power to govern ourselves under the existing social, political, and economic institutions. So we have to break down the idea of that we're just working on individual issues and confront the fact that we're actually building a movement for power. And I think that everybody, there'll be over 500 people at this convention, agrees with that. This session is, by my reckoning, one of the most important ones, because this is a session on monetary policy, not fiscal policy. So often, social change agents grapple, as we should, with how should money be spent? What sort of project should be funded? We're going deeper, a first principle. What the hell is money? Where does it come from? In this plenary session, we have three monetary research and reform organization experts to present their understanding of current monetary system, how to correct its flaws, and how to facilitate the ability to have actual community and economic democracy. I'm going to introduce them all at once, and then they'll come up in order. They'll each get 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up for discussion. The first speaker is John Bongiovanni.
Joe.
I was so comfortable. Joe Bongiovanni. I practiced so much that last one. Joe is a member of the American Monetary Institute and also the director of the Kettle Institute for Debt-Free Money. Next, we'll hear from Mark Armstrong, co-founder of both Public Banking Institute and Commonomics USA. And our last presenter will be Rohan Ray, an attorney and president of the Modern Money Network. I'm going to stop talking so that we can actually bring these three esteemed gentlemen up to the front and give us their understanding of money, monetary systems, and a survey on how their organization aims to correct it. So, look, Joe, come on out.
Thank you.
And after that, we'll be Mark and Rohan.
Okay, thank you very much, David, and thank you very much, David, for making the Economic Democracy Conference part of the Democracy Convention, because quite frankly, our feeling has always been that if there's no economic democracy, all the other democracies are just going to line up one behind the other and try to fight to reach fruition. So I want to thank David, and I want to thank the American Monetary Institute, of which I'm a member, for the opportunity to be here and to talk from the monetary reform perspective on what needs to be done in order to take that great dream that Gar was speaking of last night in terms of it manifesting itself, and to actually provide the vehicle, to actually provide the bridge, if you will, that we can get from here to there. Because without money, that's what it is, okay? That's what the revolution is. And we want the revolution. We all want the revolution. That's the one thing that I find in my dealings with all the others, presenters here and others. We all want the revolution, but how do we get it? So having said that, my little background for me, I'm going to try to give you about 40 years of student work, okay, in 15 minutes, because I'm a second-generation monetary reformer. I learned about the monetary system from my dad, because he was a monetary reformer. And he was the most unlikely, monetary reformer that anybody could imagine. You know, he was a Christian capitalist businessman, Republican voter, you know, church 7 days a week, until he ran headfirst into the fractional reserve banking system and its implications for what was going on, and he started to study about it. And eventually he tried to convince me that it was really important, and I will tell you that me and my dad had huge battles about what was important back in those days. I refused to engage anything that he was talking about, monetary reform, what does that even mean, you know? And then one day he came to me with this book, which was Dr. Frederick Soddy's book titled The Role of Money. And the role of money is the thing that we have to come to understand. The monetary system is what we need to understand. How does it really work? How does it really work? How could it really work? That's actually the subtitle of his book, which is the monetary system we have, what it is, and how we can change it to fix what's wrong. And he wrote that book, I think, in the 1920s. He's a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. So all of my knowledge comes really to me from the basic stuff, you know, the whole framework of money from my dad. You know, after I finally read that book, and I went, geez, I guess I got to get peace, you know, and the environment and social justice and all those things in order, to the point where, as my dad was telling me, monetary reform is the most important thing. And then lo and behold, a couple of years ago, I did a video with a videographer who came to the American Monetary Institute conference, and And I did a video that said, why monetary reform must become your number one issue. You know, and I said to myself afterwards, you know, gee, that's actually what my dad was trying to tell me all that time ago. So having said that, I want to make sure that what we're talking about is the monetary system, okay? When the Kettle Pond Institute for Debt-Free Money first began, first thing we did was a monetary literacy course. People do monetary literacy courses. And I started out that monetary literacy course with this one identification, to implore the identification to any listener or any reader. This monetary system is ours. The monetary system of this country belongs to we the people. Okay? And our country was founded upon a revolution that disallowed the UK, our allies, the UK, from imposing their monetary system on the colonies, who are our forefathers, are the historical entities that were there, and the colonies rose up, and they said, you know, we're not going to give up our money to use your money. We want our own money, and you can say what happens with the skirmishes and how it all developed, but we had a revolution, and after the revolution. And when the colonies came together, and they said, how are we going to govern ourselves? And in the Constitution, they said, we're going to reserve for the Congress the right to create money, to regulate the value thereof, that is, to determine the value thereof, and of other things, okay, and a foreign coin. But the point is that please take away from here that this is our money system. The monetary system of this country belongs to us. It can be anything. It can be what it is now, having privatized the government, having privatized our money system, our commons, that which is the government's role in the economy, in the political economy. You know, in terms of what is the economy? You know, it's production and consumption, supply and demand of goods and services that have to get exchanged. They have to get exchanged, or they don't go in, they don't count, they don't become. They are nothing without the exchange. And the exchange is what the role of the money is, to make sure that the transactions can happen. If there's not enough money, you know, if there's not enough, anybody wants to know about what happened in the 1930s, there was no money. There was not enough money. There was not enough money around to do anything. And so when they were going back up to through 1937 in terms of the expansions from FDR, and they got to 1937 and the Federal Reserve Bank, being a private institution free to do whatever it wants with the monetary system, said, let's increase the reserve requirements. And then the next thing you know, the money supply went down. We had the 37 mini recession. We got to 1939 and 40, if you want to talk about that as a model. And so what you can see is fluctuations in the supply of money determine the output of the national economy. It's that simple. It's that simple also on the global scale. You know, why is it, do you think, that the Bank for International Settlements director of monetary policy, Dr. William White, came out a couple of years ago and said, you know, this is not really working out like we had planned. You know, why did he say things like? We're going to have to reduce our emphasis on monetary policy, meaning nations are going to have to reduce the emphasis on monetary policy. Why? Because we have a debt-based money system. That's why. And now I'm going to get into some ideas and some quotes on this I'm going to call it a phenomenon, the phenomenon of what it is. Okay, Jamie, I've got my wrong script right here. Let's see. Okay, so I'm going to give this is a statement, so congratulations, for being here, because this is the most important subject intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon. It's so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it is widely understood and the defects remedied very soon. Mm-hmm. And to note that this was a senior credit officer from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta in 1933, speaking in support of the Chicago Plan for Monetary Reform. So we had central bankers, credit officer, saying, this is the most important subject that and if we don't fix what's wrong with this thing, we're going to be where we are today, okay? we're going to be with secular stagnation. These are the two phenomenons of our time, secular stagnation and debt overhang. There's more debt than there is money to pay the debt, okay? So that was what he said, and he said that in a larger statement. And this is another statement that was, made by or quoting by Henry Ford. It's well enough that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system. Sort of the opposite thing that Robert Hempel was saying. He was saying it's the most important subject. We have to dwell upon it. We have to figure it out. So he said, because if they did, I believe there'd be a revolution before tomorrow morning. Well, the purpose of this conference is to let everybody know that we can have that revolution tomorrow morning if we change the monetary system. If we change the monetary system, we can have that. So that's Henry Ford's quote. And this is the rest of Robert Hempel's quote. Okay? And there are some key things in here. If you understand the debt-based money system and how it has secularly stagnated the global economy, because all the nations of the world use the same debt-based money system that we do, the private bankers create all the money in the world, okay? The International Monetary Fund, the Bank for International Settlements, they are private institutions, and everything is in the world is right now governed by those private institutions, those private banking corporations. But he says if the banks were paid, no one would have a bank deposit, there'd not be a dollar of coin in circulation. Think about that. If we just paid the loan, we would have no money. But then he says we're completely dependent on commercial banks. This statement right here: someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. So if we want to get ahead, then what are we going to have to do? People are going to have to borrow money. Who wants to borrow money? Nobody. Nobody wants to be further in debt. So what happened? So it had the 1933 Chicago Plan proposal that went to FDR. And it was debated in the Congress as the Monetary Control Act of 1934 was in both houses of Congress, did not pass. But in 1939, as they were recovering out of the 1930 session, the 37-minute recession, they published this 1939 program for monetary reform. And if I could just go back just for one second, if I could, maybe I can. All right, I'm not really technically savvy, everybody knows. But anyway, okay, I'm not going to. But if you saw the authors here, Dr. Irving Fisher, okay, Paul Douglas, the most liberal progressive senator ever from the state of Illinois, and Frank Graham, who was one of the most noted economists of the era, and they were three of the co's. And so this is what they said. The task confronting us today, and still, why 1939 and 2017, why is this still the same truth? The task confronting us today is of making our American system, which we call democracy, work. No lies less in the propaganda of autocratic government from abroad than in the existence here in America of, sharecroppers, and hundreds of thousands of idle machines. On such a soil, fascist and communist propaganda can thrive without full employment. Such a grant will be neutral. And this is further from the forward of that study. My point here is so they can know. Since day one, since time immemorial in this country, has a struggle that has been going on and that needs to be understood that it's been going on. And these economists did this. Throughout our economic history, no economic problem has been more passionately discussed than the money problem. Probably none has had the distinction of suffering from general misunderstanding. And that's why my whole life is to promote monetary understandings, promote this understanding of the monetary system. And analyzing the problem, we can conclude is preeminently the responsibility of American economists to present constructive proposals. For this purpose, we drew up this program for monetary reform, which we believe comprises the essential elements. As of the date of this writing, 235 economists from 157 universities have expressed their general approval of this program. 40 more have approved it with reservations. This was at the date of the writing, but eventually over 400 economists in this country, over 400 academic economists in this country, publicly supported the 1939 program for monetary reform. When has that happened ever? When has that happened since? It hasn't, and it just goes to show you the substance of it. I know David's going to call me. So this was from their introduction. It's intended to eliminate one recognized cause of Great Depressions, which is the lawless variability in the supply of our circulating medium. Circulating medium, that's how the political economists refer to money. Okay, if it's not circulating and it's not the universally medium of exchange, it's not money. And so the... Sorry. Okay. So I'm going to be out of time. And what I'm going to say is everything from the 1939 program in terms of fractional reserve banking, full reserve banking, having a monetary authority to determine the amount of money in circulation that can bring about the prosperity that they wanted is all in the Kucinich Bill. It's all in H.R. 2990, which is the work of AMI and Dennis Kucinich. And if there was ever a more progressive member of Congress, somebody should tell me who he is, because even Bernie Sanders, when he was the guy, was there. You know, Dennis Kucinich was more progressive than Bernie Sanders. And my hat off to Dennis Kucinich, because he's one of the few Congress people that ever knew what money was. And we have the work of AMI. We have the Kucinich Bill. It's been entered into Congress. It's words that are written down that changes the structure of the law so that people can take back the money system. And that's what we want to do. And I'll have to end it right there.
As Mark comes up, remember that these are 15-minute surveys. I really want to remind folks that each one of our presenters will then be given another full session after it. So your challenge is going to be to decide which one of these theories has inspired me the most or makes the most sense or I want to learn more about. So we will have a discussion in this session following the presentations, but each one of these monetary systems or theories are also given another full session to go even deeper. And with that, let's bring up Mark Armstrong of Commonomics USA.
All right. Hi, everyone. My starting point's a little different from Joe's, and the thing that got me really interested in public banking is the conversation, the public conversation. You'll see it on the headlines every other week, it seems like, of public budgets, you know, and how you fund a public budget, especially in light of a revenue shortfall, which is what happened in 2009-2010 after the recession. You know, the folks that we elected into office had a huge problem on their hands because they had projected revenues to be X, and what it was in reality was X minus something. And so they had to do something significant in order to restructure their budgets. And the conversation is always along the following lines. It's four or five different things. It's you either raise taxes, you cut the expenses, you raid from a future budget that's been already set aside, or you sell a public asset. And, you know, Arizona has sold their state house building. There have been Indiana's basically sold off with a 99-year lease, Interstate 80 through the top part of the state. Chicago sold off their parking system, and rates went up quite a bit. So it's those four or five different levers which are always discussed by our public officials as to how to fund a public budget. And the core issue is that public finance has been completely privatized in 49 of the 50 states. And so that brings me to North Dakota and what they do. They have the same sort of issues, okay, so they have the same four or five choices. And they also have another alternative. And the alternative is not to fund deficit financing, but it's a public bank which can finance public projects. It's not on the books of the short-term budget. And so they've given themselves an option by having this public bank, because what they do is issue credit to themselves. And so let me just use an example. In California, the San Francisco Bay Bridge was built. It cost $6.4 billion in materials and services. It's another $6 billion in fees and service fees and interest that are going to be paid to the bankers. Now, in the papers, you always read about the $6.4 billion cost. You don't recognize that there's going to be the price is essentially doubled because it was financed externally. If they had done that in North Dakota, and they do public projects like that in North Dakota, major ones, not quite that large, but what they do is they issue the loan to themselves, essentially to these JPA or something. And then the case in point is the Western North Dakota Water Authority. There was quite a few tens of millions of dollars of loans that were paid to it, and in order to build out the water pipeline to the western part of North Dakota. And there was all sorts of issues because the water trucks that were owned by private firms and chewing up the public roads, They all said, you can't do that. That's socialism to put in a water pipe. The state of North Dakota did it anyway, and which is an interesting conversation because it's a very red state. And then the water fees, the roads are protected, the water fees that people pay for the water goes to pay for the interest on that loan, and the guess who receives that interest? It's the Bank of North Dakota, and then they in turn return it either by providing it back to the general budget or by keeping it as capital retained earnings for the bank. And so it's a closed loop system that's very effective in determining their own economic sovereignty. And that's the core value proposition with public banking. You're basically taking an existing system, the banking system. Credit has issues, we all recognize that. But instead of being indebted to private financiers, you're indebted to yourself. And you can use the banking system to basically further your economic interests and be very effective at that. And the state of North Dakota has done that. We were getting hit with the response that, well, the reason why the state of North Dakota is doing so well is because of the oil boom. But you know, in the last 2+ years, the oil prices have crashed, and yet they still continue to expand their bank. And as well as their economy. And it's not just because of the oil resource. I mean, California and other states have plenty of sunshine, and you know, is that fueling their economy? And I would argue no, because there are all sorts of issues with the financing end of how you capture that sunlight or that renewable energy and turn it into something productive for your economy. Another case in point is in Sonoma County, in Sonoma County, they have something called the SCIPE program, Sonoma County Energy Independence Program. It was $60 million of taxpayer money, which was used to fund installation of solar panels on residential houses. And so what they did was they blew through that fairly quickly and then had to partner with private banks in order to expand that amount of money. And the issue was a couple-fold. I mean, they were charging 7% interest, and they were basically furthering the interest of private banks by inviting them in on this. And what they could have done is use that $60 million instead of loaning it out like you would with a revolving loan fund or something like that, use that as capital for a bank. They would have had approximately $500 million of credit capacity based upon that capital investment, and been able to do an excellent job of meeting the needs of solar installation requirements throughout Sonoma County at a much more reasonable rate than 7%, which is what they were charging, and that interest would have gone back to the public bank. So that's kind of the perspective I have with regards to public banking. When we look at the benefits for public banking, I've talked about the cost savings, and they can be significant. If just a case in point, in North Dakota, they are doing infrastructure loans 30 years at 2% per annum. And so that's a very important, that's very low. That's lower than the municipal bond market. And what they're doing is being able to build their infrastructure, create jobs, create more wealth. You know, when you look at public services as part of wealth of our communities, they're able to create more wealth for their communities, and they're doing it at a very low rate. So there's these cost savings, and when you look at commercial loans or student loan debt consolidation, these are all programs that they have. They have over 25 programs in place, lending programs in place throughout North Dakota for various different demographic groups. And what's important is that there are cost savings throughout all of those, and so it's much more competitive than what the private banking industry provides. So, the other cost savings is one benefit. The other benefit is has to do with economic sovereignty, as I've touched on. It's a democratic approach to public finance, essentially. Last year, the Bank of North Dakota had over 40 meetings throughout the state where their officers went out to different parts of the state to talk with people about their infrastructure financing needs. And as a result of that, they put over $500 million into an infrastructure financing loan fund at that competitive rate I mentioned. and they're very much focused on getting feedback from the community and then tailoring their loan programs to meet their needs. Another example of this was in 1997, when the Red River flooded. Folks from Minnesota know about that. That was the second most costliest natural disaster up till that point. Katrina and others came later. But all of downtown Grand Forks and East Grand Forks were flooded. And there was a fire in Grand Forks as well. Well, the Bank of North Dakota was called in because the issue that people in Grand Forks were facing is that FEMA had been created, and they could get reimbursed by FEMA, but that was going to be 6 months, 7 months down the road. And what do they do as a supply of money until that point? And so the Bank of North Dakota came in, and within 2 weeks, they had put in place emergency funding loan programs, which were extremely effective, to loan small businesses and homeowners the money that they needed to get back up on their feet. They put a six-month moratorium on home mortgage payments that were made to the Bank of North Dakota. They put a six-month moratorium on student loan payments that were made to the Bank of North Dakota. Have you ever heard a private bank do anything like this? And it's all because it's a democratic approach to public finance or banking. And so they're responsible to their owners, which are the people of North Dakota. And so this is not a socialist thing or whatever. It is just the fact of the matter is that you've got an institution which is a public service managed by public servants, and it is accountable to the people of North Dakota. That's essentially their mission statement. So, final benefit. So we've got cost savings. We also have it's an economic approach to it's a democratic approach to economic sovereignty. The final benefit is a little more in the economics world, but it's basically counter-cyclical. When you look, there have been studies done on public banks throughout the world, and there are plenty of public banks in both developed and undeveloped economies. But what here's the core issue. When we all think back on what happened in 2008, 2009, you go back and look at the stock market prices of the Wall Street banks, and any bank that was publicly traded, and what was $100 in capital ended up being $50, $40, $30 in capital over the course of a year. And so you ended up with this almost five-fold reduction in capital for these banks. Because capital is the fundamental building block for a bank, there are multiples based on that. You can only have so many deposits based upon the capital and so many loans. What happens when your capital is reduced by 80%? You've got to shed your loans, you've got to shed your deposits. Do you remember the stories back in 2008, 2009? That the bank won't even take my money. I can't even put a deposit in the bank. I can't even get a loan. Lots of people cannot get loans. And that was the ripple effect throughout the economy, is this credit contraction because of the private banks having this issue with their capital, the value of their capital being reduced so much. Not so with the Bank of North Dakota, not so with any other public bank. Because they are not publicly traded, they don't have the variable value of their capital. And so their numbers, their ratios come through pretty fine, and they can actually, you can look at it a couple of different ways, they can actually increase lending precisely when the private banks are contracting lending. So that means they're counter-cyclical from an economic point of view. And when a recession hits North Dakota, and there are other examples throughout the country or throughout the world, does not have as big of a hit as California and other places would. So those are the three benefits: cost savings, economic determination, and our sovereignty, as well as it being counter-cyclical, which is a really important benefit. We don't talk about it that much, but it's one of the key things that you need to know about public banking. I got a couple of announcements to make. I've been involved in the cannabis banking working group set up by John Chung, who's the treasurer of California. As a result of some of the meetings and the lobbying effort from me and a number of other people, there is going to be an entire session on public banking next Thursday, August 10th. In Los Angeles. There'll be 5 hours of testimony provided by my colleague Matt Stannard, myself, and a number of other people in the public banking world talking about the history of public banking, talking about how public banks can work with cannabis. And of course, the private bankers will be there, and there'll be issues that they'll raise. And it'll be a really good discussion. It's probably the first time that there's been this large a public discussion. You can go to John Chung's, the Treasurer of California's website. There's a cannabis banking working group. It'll be live streamed. Please, if you're interested, take a look at that. It's throughout the day, 9:30 to 2 o'clock next Thursday, the 10th. And here's some additional information. I'll be going through this in a session right after this, if you can pass this around. Thanks, everyone.
Next, Rohan Gray of the Modern Money Network.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me here. As you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not from the United States, so it's a pleasure to be invited here. I came via Australia. I studied international studies. I was an elementary school teacher in Harlem for a while. I was a lawyer in Brooklyn Family Court representing children in custody abuse cases, and now I work consulting on monetary reform in developing countries and research around legal history of money. So I like that Thoreau quote that says there are 1,000 hacking at the root, the branches for every one hacking at the root of evil. And I live about 15 minutes from Wall Street now in Brooklyn, so I feel like I've come a long way in my journey, but I'm pretty close. And I just like to reiterate Joe and Mark's points that, you know, we are here because we all share a belief in progressive change and the idea that the monetary system and how we understand economics and the relationship between the language of money and broader economic policy discussions to be a critical hurdle to be overcome to achieve genuine progressive change. So I'm going to stay at a relatively high level and do a bit of an elevated pitch about the who, what, and why of modern monetary theory, or MMT as it's known in public. And I'm going to sort of stay out of the weeds of the discussion of the technicals, which you can hear in the panel after this, as David mentioned. So first of all, starting with the who, there were a number of founders in the MMT community that then built a community that now exists across the world. There are millions of people who engage with MMT ideas, people all the way up at the top level of policy in multiple countries around the world, down to people in Facebook and Twitter arguments who just came across this stuff because they care about it. So we try to be a very broad church and to look at the sort of anybody that is interested in these ideas from an equal perspective, even as we're trying to stay relevant in the halls where the actual discussions get made and where the insider knowledge is sufficient to understand these problems in their entirety. So the founders have a various backgrounds. A lot of them were initially economics professors or practitioners. Some were former monetary policy committee members of the Bank of England. Others were insiders in financial operations for 20, 30 years. But they came together around shared interests, particularly around understanding how the monetary system worked and how it related to the financial system, and how that understanding was in the way of conceiving a broader political change, but also a broader set of progressive values that wouldn't necessarily have been obvious just by looking at their backgrounds or looking at them from the outside, given the work that they were interested in, that didn't necessarily manifest itself on a day-to-day basis, but ultimately was the driving factor behind various parts of their lives. So they came together around a concern for public and common protection and management, individual civil liberties, environmental sustainability, workers' rights, egalitarian economic systems, and general anti-oppressive, anti-imperialist, anti-corrupt, and anti-predatory economic systems. So the vision that they share, I believe, based on my exposure and over a number of years greater integration within that community, is a belief in social change via grassroots driven movements. And they see themselves and they see the MMT body of ideas and the community and the resources that it builds as primarily sort of like military intelligence for social justice activists. So not the main story, but an important story to be able to run interference against the other side who are attempting to write interference on actual change. And grounded in that is an understanding of the role of social narratives and social myths in shaping public discourse. And we can see that whether it's about banking, as Mark was talking about, or about how money works and where money comes from, as Joe was talking about, but more broadly just this idea that there are a range of different understandings in different parts of the monetary system, whether it's banking or public finance or shadow finance, or even down to how individuals make private credit relationships with each other that ends up functioning like a form of money, that all of these things compound each other and it ends up having a worldview that feels internally consistent right up until the point that it isn't. Much as for a long period of time, Ptolemaic physics purported to provide some sort of vision of how the stars worked, and geocentric models of the universe proposed to provide some sort of coherent vision of how the world worked right up until the point that they couldn't. It explained certain things and the whole edifice was revealed to be faulty. So one of the things that MMT looks at is the need to tackle all of these different components and all of these different myths together, and the way that they construct a totality of a worldview rather than merely looking at one issue in isolation. At the same time, the community that has formed, in my experience, I came to it through the internet, and the MMT initial developers first came together from different parts of the globe. One was in California, one was up in northeast United States, one was down in Sydney, Australia, so I guess I had sort of some predisposition to getting involved, but they came together through an internet email list. So it was one of the first groups of academics using these email lists in the early 90s, and they found a common interest, and over time, all of the materials that they've been produced have been publicly available. It hasn't been something that's been behind closed doors, and over time, people just came to these ideas over around the world and joined in. So there are people who primarily express or participate in this community online through social media. Others do it in the streets, in social activist organizations, or even just in their homes, in their communities, where they talk to their friends and family. Others do it in the academy or in community institutions and organizations, and others are working sort of behind the scenes in governments and in the halls of power and industry in different areas. So one of the things that brings people together is that it's a coalitional approach. People don't necessarily share the same tribal affiliations or identities. They don't even necessarily share the same country, but they come together around a set of ideas and a set of beliefs of certain things that need to be fixed. And like all serious political movements that actually achieve change, not everybody has to agree with everybody on everything, as long as they agree with each other on the things that are important. And what MMT has done as a large body of theory that has multiple angles and dimensions is continue to provide a focus around, on one side, monetary system reform, and on the other side, around the real economic production part of the economy, which gets represented in their advocacy for full employment programs like the Job Guarantee, primarily the Job Guarantee, but connected to others. And those two limbs become the two sort of planks of the reform movement that then allows people to sort of see whether or not they wish to be affiliated or with that coalition, or see it to be sufficiently comprehensive to be something to devote their time and energy behind. So what is MMT? As I was saying earlier, it is a conceptual and historical framework. It's a set of ideas, and we can talk about those ideas in the next panel. At the same time as describing how the world is through a theoretical lens, it's also providing a set of normative critiques and proposed solutions. So it says, because the world is this way, these are things that shouldn't happen, and here's how we can stop them from happening. And then embedded in that, and perhaps more subtly, but also fundamentally, is a theory of political power and social change. So here's why focusing on these particular things is likely to actually achieve results. rather than simply that these are important problems or these are real problems. These are problems we can actually win and achieve change that then has ripple-on effects in other areas of policy. So embedded in the MMT analysis, because it has a multi-dimensional viewpoint, it sifts through these different issues and finds the ones that are the most sensitive to pressure and therefore change. And lastly, MMT is a community of people. So it's not simply a body of ideas, it's not simply one person or one organization, it is a brand or an identity that a lot of people are in a constant process of defining and redefining. So on one hand, that may make it feel more amorphous, on the other hand, any important concept or unifying community in history has had an internal dialogue about its identity, and that's fundamental to the way that MMT understands itself as a political project. So it talks about, how money and finance works. Sorry, I rushed through this, yeah. So the last question is why, relative to sort of other progressive monetary reform efforts, what sets MMT apart? And I just want to reiterate that MMT is generally fully supportive of the idea that money is a public good and should be employed for public interest. It's fully supportive of the idea that public banking is a very important structural feature. And so this isn't a matter of saying those other alternative approaches are wrong. It's a matter of a different emphasis or a different framing or a different set of problems that may be prioritized over others. So one thing I would say is that in addition to it not just being one organization or one person or one idea, it's also not just one angle of attack. So MMT provides a technical analysis, but it also provides a historical analysis and a set of publicly accessible language, memes, slogans, etc., that can be packaged and weaponized in different contexts. So it operates at a sort of low church and high church level at different times, which may make it, again, seem internally sort of in tension with itself, whereas in reality that's simply how these large, complicated packages of ideas have to be communicated across audiences with varying degrees of literacy in the subject matter, attention span, ability to follow up and continue to ask questions, etc. Even the very nature of this conversation versus what might follow afterwards is going to be obviously of a different degree of detail and of scope. At the same time, it's also multidimensional, so it combines a focus on fiscal and monetary policy and banking with a look at how accounting laws get made, how payments technology and payment systems operate, how real production and real economic development in a global context occurs, and the political and geopolitical constraints on that process that interfere or interact with monetary system design. In that respect, it's a sort of everywhere all the time approach to understanding the problem, even as it ultimately distills down the proposed ways forward. Another aspect is that it's evolutionary, which is what I was also talking about earlier, in the sense that in addition to having an ongoing dialogue about its identity, it's constantly integrating new components into it. So just to give an example, our organization, the Modern Money Network, is only 5 years old, even though the MMT community has been around since at least the mid-1990s. In an identifiable form. One of the things that our organization has brought is a renewed emphasis on the legal dimension, so legal institutional details and the role of legal dynamics. So the idea that the strategy you watch in a John Grisham movie in court actually has a political impact in the way that debt contracts may get enforced in the context of private or public finance, or the way that administrative law decisions about the FCC or the FDA may have relevance to understanding the politics of an institution like the Federal Reserve or other central banks around the world. Just lastly, quickly, it's aiming primarily to be empowering rather than exploitative of its community. So going to this idea of being a military intelligence wing for social movements, it's not saying come and pay us money, we have the secrets to template, saying here's the information, we think you might find it useful, we're happy to try and help you use it if you want it, that's what we're here to do. And lastly, it's about its competence in the sense that a lot of the people coming to this community, because it is coalitional, are people who have worked in positions where they've had access to decision-making and access to information that isn't always available to other people. And while certain people in the community aren't always able to be the ones to put that information forward for optical reasons and things, that information becomes part of the general community. So to give an example very quickly, when the Greek government Syriza got into power in 2015 in Greece, one of the issues that they faced was they didn't have the people in their community with the technical capacity to staff institutions like the National Central Bank of Greece overnight. They simply just didn't have that institutional competence in their ranks of their members once they finally were given the keys to the castle. So one of the things that MMT is trying to do is build that institutional competence and find the people who have experience in these systems to then be able to take it over. I'll end there and just say that it's a real pleasure to be here with everybody, and thank you for taking the time, and happy to answer any further questions in the workshop.
I gotta tell you, folks, I have never had an easier time as a timekeeper on such a core issue. So what we're gonna do, I see you'll be first. I just want to point out my observation. So there's actually a lot of agreement amongst the three. So what I heard is there is absolute agreement that the money system is absolutely foundational to any social change effort. I think I also heard a absolute agreement that money is a construct and that we can create it and use it however we want. I think I also heard an agreement that money is a public good. So that's actually a lot of agreement. I think I also actually heard, if correct, that as between, if I can say, positive money or AMI and modern monetary theory, that public banking is a particular approach that both sides would say there is a path forward. So there is some agreement there. Maybe I'm wrong about it. So what I'll do is now ask if you want to ask a question, raise your hand. Remember, so I'm going to start with, sir, I saw your hand first. Ma'am, you will be number two. Sir, you will be number three. You will be number four. Did I see a hand back here? Howard, you will be number five. Sir, you will be number six. So we're going to do those six. I'm going to ask you to please be brief with your question. If you want to direct it to one of our particular panelists, you can. Remember your number. Number one.
Are the responses coming after all six then? We hear the six.
No. We're going to hear. So please. No.
Okay. So I don't know who can answer this best, but is there a strategy to get rid of the Federal Reserve and create a national public bank like the Bank of North Dakota so that we have a money system that's public rather than private? And if there is, what is that strategy and who's leading it?
All right, so I'm going to start with you, Mark, because...
So there's no strategy that I know of on anybody's part to get rid of the Federal Reserve within the public banking community. It's also true that a bank like the State Bank of North Dakota effectively acts to some extent as a central bank for that state, for that local economy. So both are true.
So, Joe?
Yeah, definitely there's a strategy to get rid of the Federal Reserve. It's really simple. You know, the Federal Reserve was an institution that was established by the Congress, so the Congress can change the Federal Reserve Act at any time. The Monetary Control Act 1934 that I had mentioned earlier said that the Treasury will buy out the stock into Federal Reserve banks and put the Federal Reserve under Treasury. And when the Federal Reserve is under Treasury, it's public. So there definitely is that part of it. In terms of a working strategy to accomplish that, you know, that's why we're here. And let's look for the takeaway at the end of the conference to see, you know, how much we've moved in the direction of being able to take those steps. Ours is to propose that Congress people pick up the Kucinich bill because it's a piece of work that accomplishes all of the things that we want to be able to accomplish.
So I think one of the things that's important about getting into the institutional granularity is to look at what we're actually talking about when we say the Federal Reserve is private and what we actually mean when we say we want the Federal Reserve to become public. So to give an example, if you're talking about not wanting to have the government have to pay interest every time it runs a deficit, you're not actually talking about a form of privatizing the money supply. You're talking about an interest rate that's being set on government money. That is a function of monetary policy. So you could issue greenbacks tomorrow, but as long as there is some form of monetary policy, whether it's conducted by the Fed or conducted by the Treasury, that says we want to pay a positive interest rate because we think that's a good idea for whatever reason, and I don't agree with that, for the record. But if they decide that's a good thing, then they're going to be able to effectively turn that into debt-based money again, or interest-earning money, however you want to describe it. So that's one issue, is to actually understand where the operational change needs to happen. Another thing is that talking about the FDA or the FCC as being a captured agency, nobody says it's private. So the question of why we think of the Federal Reserve as private comes down to the particular institutional structure. And it's one thing to say that we are appointing people to in positions of leadership and policy-making responsibility who shouldn't be there, who aren't accountable to public interest. It's another thing to say that the institution itself is private. As Joe noted, it's a creature of Congress. The Federal Open Market Committee that sets monetary policy decisions does so explicitly according to statutory rules. Even though there are these things called shares, they don't function at all like corporate shares. They don't function in a way to give ownership rights. Banks cannot vote tomorrow to take higher profit dividends out of the Federal Reserve System. So it's important to look at the institutional design and actually work out what the things you have a problem with are, so then you can work out how to design a solution to fix those things, rather than just to say we don't like this whole thing because it's private, and open it up to a critique that that you're not interested in institutional nuance, you're not interested in what's actually going on, you just want to have a slogan that feels good but doesn't actually mean anything.
Number two.
Well, public banking seems to me the banking word and public oxymoron, so it bothers me a little bit. But my question is that what is the relationship between public banking, if any, and credit union? That individual.
Mark, I'm going to ask you alone to answer that one so we can make
sure.
Get through our...
So credit unions have been constrained significantly by federal regulation so that they can only have about 12.5% of their assets be issued as commercial loans. And so the private banking lobby has been very effective at hamstringing credit unions from being able to essentially compete with them. A public bank does not have that constraint, and so because it's a bank, it'd be a commercial, essentially a commercial bank, and so you end up with the ability of a public bank to do all the things that they're doing in North Dakota, for instance, because that's a real life example. They put the Bank of North Dakota puts $6,300 of credit per capita into the economy. So they've been able to use their credit-generating capacity to put over $6,000 into the economy per capita. And you can do the math here in Minnesota or other states. Those are really big numbers when you look at it, because it's all because they have this tool which they use to generate credit. A credit union, even though it says credit in the term credit union, does not have that capacity.
Number three.
Hi, this is another question about public banking, which I find makes so much sense. On the other hand, it seems to mainly focus on capital expenditures, infrastructure, and so on, whereas the NEED Act is more, I guess, universal. It can cover things like healthcare and so on. And I'm wondering what your thought is on that. And also, it kind of begs the question, why do we have a public bank? Do we need to pay interest on it?
Okay, so to your first question, I think the public banking folks have been looking more at the credit side of the equation. Next week, when we give testimony to the Cannabis Banking Working Group, we're going to be focusing on two additional areas which are overlooked by the existing banking system. One is to provide deposit accounts to cannabis businesses, and the other is to provide deposit accounts to the unbanked and underbanked. Within the United States, 19.1% of the people, of households, are underbanked. And so because of that, they're paying exorbitant fees for check cashing, things like that. So we're making this formal proposal next week as part of our testimony, and that's on the liability side of the balance sheet, or the deposit services side of the balance sheet. when we talk about interest with regards to credit, you can't get money for nothing. I mean, there's always this offsetting balance sheet entry against a loan, and the money has to be there, and very often you're paying interest on that. And so you certainly have to cover those costs and make a little profit in order to fund the operations of the bank. And but as a result of it not having bonuses, not having shareholder dividends, not having a number of expenses that private banks do, you end up reducing your cost basis significantly, and that can be passed on to the people who are receiving credit. So that's as best as can be done. Now, it is true that in North Dakota, they do sometimes buy down the interest rate. They use their half penny sales tax to buy down interest rates so that something that was priced at 5% per year, a commercial loan, is only at 1% for the next 3 or 4 years. And so they do that for specific reasons, and usually in the manufacturing area. And so there are ways to use tax revenues in order to buy down that interest rate.
Number four.
This is again about North Dakota. North Dakota is so red. How do they manage to maintain this public banking system, and aren't they facing any challenges?
So, you know, we've got to get past labels. You know, the folks in North Dakota are just good folks. My family's from there originally, and you know, I living in Western Virginia, which is a very conservative area. You know. There are a lot of rednecks there, and we were talking last night, I'm becoming a redneck because it's just a pretty cool thing, and also it's just, I sleep on the ammunition, and that is just what we do in Western Virginia. Slaughter hogs, and so a good portion of our country's people are redneck,
but redneck and red.
Yeah, I know, but my overall point is that I think Americans, just generalizing, are pretty practical, and the folks in North Dakota look at this bank and they've made it work for them, and they've just squeegeed out the labels. They don't care about you know, it having that socialist background or whatever. So yeah.
Number five. Whoever you were, I asked you to.
I'm asking. Joe, what were the essential elements of the NEED Act and the AMI proposal that changed the law?
Okay, so first I'll say, yeah, they're exactly the same as what was in that 1939 program for monetary reform, okay? And they are to take the Fed and put it under Treasury, to publicize, if you will, the Federal Reserve system. Because that was the difference in terms of how it was created. And then to take that power that they have to use fractional reserve banking to create money, to take that power back to the government so that the government would issue the money. Okay? And that's kind of the really most critical thing, because when the government can create money, it can create money without cost. Okay, when it uses the money power to create money, that's how it would do that.
And disallow the banks from doing that.
And to stop the banks from creating the money. Okay, so in other words, you can't have. What is interestingly how Lord Adair Turner, in the end of his book on Between Debt and the Devil, you know, where he totally identifies debt and the problem of debt, which I totally agree with those two parts of his book. When he gets into the solutions, he says, well, we should allow fractional reserve banking to continue. And then when it can't deliver, you know, the national economy into its potential, then we should bring in overt monetary finance. Overt monetary finance, from some, you know, central banker talk, it just means creating money, having the government to create the money. So those are the elements. And those are the elements that must all remain. That was one of the things when I found the American Monetary Institute myself, after 30 years of studying the monetary system, and I saw that they had a draft piece of legislation in there before the Kucinich bill, you know, that said, what are the elements? Those are the same elements that my dad said, you don't do these three and do all of these three, you can't be successful, or the grandkids will be back here doing this all again. So those are the three elements. They have to be all in there together.
Number six.
Yes. The similarities between the three positions, notwithstanding, I was wondering whether Mark will say something about your thoughts on whether money is or should be credit or debt. This is sort of the one distinguishing issue for me, just as a listener. It would be interesting for me to hear whether in your positions, whether money is or should be debt or credit.
Sure. So I think, again, this is one of these times when the clarity of the wording is really important. So what do we mean by debt here? There's one way of looking at debt, which is something that pays interest. That's one way you can define debt. But in that case, a treasury bond that pays zero interest, like there's a lot of out there right now, shouldn't be considered debt. So that term doesn't clarify, doesn't capture fully what we might think of as debt. Another one could be something that has a maturity, so that it doesn't turn into something that can be used as a final means of payment until a certain point in the future. But again, in a system where you have liquid money markets that are backed by central banks, if I'm holding a 3-month or a 30-year treasury bond, I can always turn it into cash at a moment's notice, then that maturity doesn't really function like maturity in the way that we actually think of it. We're not holding on to that for 30 years. So what the MMT position is that they would say taxes drive money, and what they mean by that is money, in the government money, has value as a tax credit. So you can, almost like in Monopoly, when you have the get-out-of-jail-free card, if the tax man comes with the thugs behind them saying, we're going to come take your house away, you can come and give them a tax credit, and you stay out of jail, or you keep your assets, you keep your home. Now, from the perspective of MMT, we would say that creates a debt on behalf of the state to accept those dollars back. And that might sound like nothing to the state, because, okay, well, so what? It doesn't matter. We just rip up the piece of paper. But from a real political perspective, it is a cost. Because if I tax you $100 because I want to take your house away and I want to bankrupt you, but then somebody gives you $100 to pay your taxes, I can't bankrupt you without imposing another $100 of taxes. And it's not easy to raise taxes. It's certainly not easy to raise taxes on you alone if I want to get your house in particular. So because there is a real political cost to imposing, collecting, and enforcing taxes, then the ability to get out of jail free with your tax credit is a real asset to an individual and a real liability to a government. That doesn't mean it has to be recorded on a balance sheet anywhere. It could be an invisible balance sheet. It could be something that defies being calculated in a number. What's the value of $100 of get out of jail free? That you can't really assess that in terms of dollar values, but it is real political value. So the MMT position would be that whether you call it a greenback or a gold dollar coin, or you call it a 30-year bond, you can have interest payments, you can have maturities, and those things are important. And as I said, I am all for zero interest government liabilities being issued. But we would still call them debts, because we would call them debts because they are a debt of the government to accept it back. The government's promising you that next time the tax man comes, you can get out of jail free this time. It's like putting the blood on the door of a Passover.
That's helpful. Probably I should clarify. Since, as I understand it, and I'm not a subject matter expert, much of the money in circulation is commercial credit or debt. So my question is, should money be private commercial bank debt? So this is probably the nuance.
It's a nuanced question. I don't want to sort of take up the whole oxygen in the room, but the short answer is, if you go to a bar and pay a bar tab, and you don't pay the bar tab until the end of the night, but you buy $50 worth of drinks, until you close out your bar tab, you've got $50 worth of goods that you've consumed. That bartender has $50 that it has coming from you. In that period of time, your $50 is in two places at once. So credit creation happens, or something that functions in a way very similar to money creation, happens all over the economy at all different times. Bank deposits have special features that give them a level of safety and a level of moneyness that is higher than a lot of other kinds of debt, but not all kinds of debt. So I work with people that do mobile money development in sub-Saharan Africa and other places, and in those places, they have a working banking system, but it was the mobile money operators that ended up functioning, creating a form of money, like whether it was airtime minutes or whether it was just the equivalent of frequent flyer miles that they issued, because they ran the payment system And so, and similarly, up at the wholesale banking level, you have people who have hundreds of millions of dollars that play around with assets that function like money. So yes, we would say that the banking system does create money right now that functions a lot of us as money. It would be good to reduce that power, but to eliminate all forms of private money is to eliminate all forms of private credit, which is to effectively have a level of legal enforcement that's so draconian and says you can't create a bar tab at your local bar. And we would say that's where it gets problematic.
When you go to the bar, you actually get beer. The bank is manufacturing what it... If you borrow $100 from me, I actually have to give you $100. But the bank has the ability to manufacture...
No, but I could give you an IOU, and you could go buy someone else's IOU for that. And we could create a whole little financial market where we just trade in POS cards, POG cards, or whatever. And it could be a million things that we trade in that could be completely intangible. So what a bank is doing is giving you access to its network of acceptability. This is why Hyman Minsky, the monetary reformer, called the function of banks is the exception, acceptance function, because it takes your IOU and gives you a bank IOU in response. But people accept the bank's IOU far more widely than they would accept your IOU. So if you want $100 to buy a house, you get a bank IOU, you can actually use it to buy a house. You can't use it mine. But my point is, you can do it with mobile money in sub-Saharan Africa, and you can do it with a whole range of financial instruments up at the top level of the financial chain. So it's not just government-issued liabilities, and it's not just bank deposits that function as money. There's a much broader spectrum of money, and the attempt to eliminate all of it, or probably prohibit all of it, would become draconian very quickly. So that's our concern.
Mark?
Yeah, real quick. I think the examples that Rowan's been talking about are examples of distributed systems. And to me, that makes the whole system much less fragile. You know, when you have a centralized control at the top or in a power center, and you're relying upon them for making the rules of the system, becomes a very fragile system. And when you have distributed systems, there's much more play and give in the system. And in addition, I would like to say that the good thing about credit is that you can create it out of nothing. It is something that does not require a lot of, you know, one of the issues with money is that it's perceived to have value, and there's the assumption that it needs to be scarce. And credit is neither one of those two. And that's why I like it, is because it's something that can be used to effectively further the economy, and you're creating it out of nothing. Of course, there are rules associated with it, but it stands, there's value associated with that particular system in addition to hard currency and other things. So that's my answer.
So we've got time for one, maybe two more, so I'm going to go number one and number two.
I'm interested in both MMT and public banking, and it seems to me that MMT is only applicable at the federal level, and that public banking seems to work well at the local level or state level. So I'm wondering if you two see those two as being compatible, or if you find that there's some sort of incompatibility between them.
I don't see it as being incompatible at all. I mean, I haven't rolled up my sleeves that much to really understand MMT, but I know that it is a little uncomfortable to me to be here talking about monetary reform, because public banking is more of an implementation of the existing system, but just having it be more public and local control. It's not monetary reform at a global or much national level, but it's very simpatico with MMT, I think. So
yeah, I mean, people like Randall Ray, who was one of the first developers of MMT, has and Hyman Minsky for years put out proposals for a community bank-based model that would replace the private banking system with a network of small public banks to do the sort of capital development of the economy. But at the same time, MMT is a theory of how you can create value up to a currency. The fact that the most obvious example is a federal level doesn't mean that's the only example. So you can create a local community currency, and as long as it's backed by something that functions like a tax. So at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where a lot of the MMT economists are based, they charge people 5% of their economics course grade, and they get tokens to pay the tax for that by doing work in the community. And so they've created a monetary complementary currency economy there using the MMT insight that as soon as you can impose a tax, you can give value to this otherwise valueless tax credit. And once this value this thing, then people are going to go out and do stuff for it than they otherwise wouldn't. And that's in operation. There's a guy called Will Ruddick that does this in Uganda. There's a guy called Josh Ryan Collins who's done this in Brixton and Bristol. Bernard Leiter, who was one of the designers of the euro, has been a big promoter of what he calls monetary pluralism and complementary currencies around the world. And there's an economist at York University called Mark Peacock that wrote a great article called Complementary Currencies, History, Theory, Prospects, that looks at the intersection of chartalism, which is the academic term for MMT, and complementary currencies. So just because it's most vivid at the federal level or may have the most political impact there doesn't mean the insights can't be applied well. But it's entirely complementary.
Number two, you had the last question.
My question was, so it sounds like North Dakota is doing a good job of this public banking model in the United States. I'm wondering if globally, if there's any countries specifically that are doing a good job also, or some systems, some countries that we can look at that are implementing,
sure,
you know, a successful national model or strong monetary policy or, you know, something that,
right,
makes sense.
There's quite a variety of implementations of public banking. In Chile, the public bank is really focused on families. So they provide all sorts of deposit and account services to family as well as education. In Germany, another more developed country, there are hundreds of municipal banks, which are called Sparkassen banks. And these Sparkassen banks have been primarily responsible for Germany being able to focus on getting off of nuclear energy. They made a commitment to get off nuclear energy by 2030, I think it was.
Thanks to the Green Party.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
And that is that's happening because they're directing their public credit to funding. They funded over 250,000 loans to put rooftop solar and other forms of renewable energy just in the last 4 years. So that's a really good example of how a public bank can serve a public bank network, in this case, can serve the political objectives with a heated issue like this. So
thank you, Mark. So folks, I want to remind you, AMI Positive Money, room 120 to go even deeper. This was literally, obviously, a survey, right? Public Banking Commonomics with Mark in room 140. Modern Monetary Theory and with Rohan Gray in room 145, all in this building. The way I look at this is we're in the early stages, or at least certainly I am, of really trying to understand money as a public good. What is the difference between the creation of money as debt and money as credit? I am still a student of it myself. I am doing my best. The fact that we are convening the space to have both MMT and positive money, I'm not trying to break my arm patting myself on the back, but what we're trying to do is actually say we need to begin to grapple with these core principles, first principles, if you will. I want to ask you to join me in thanking all three of our presenters for this level of dialogue. Thank you so much. Keep around, there's a lot more to come.
If you set it up for me, I gotta be able to press a button and then.
I'll have it set up. I might want to record Jamie, but we're recording him, right? Yeah.